love, so you go, girl. But where's the love at? Tell me where's the hugs at? Acting like a rugrat, I know where you're above that. Who try to gas me, girl? I know the streets well. You're money hungry and you make a trick or treat set. So leave it up to me, I close the whole damn store. I got nothing to
love. There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the March 2024 edition of No Borders Media, part of CKUT's Off the Hour. On today's show, we feature an interview with organizer and author Mustafa Hanawe. Mustafa is an organizer with the Immigrant Workers Center in Montreal, as well as the author of Essential Work, Disposable Workers, Migration, Capitalism, and Class. In this interview, Mustafa discusses the current political climate, which combines the rise of the far right and the suffocation of migrant justice politics. He speaks to the clarity this moment can offer and how to deal with the cognitive dissonance of the appropriation of left talking points by some elements of the right. He discusses in detail his book and the inspiration of various strike for status movements in the United States and France. We end the interview with a reflection on resistance to neoliberal capitalist economics in Canada since the 1980s. No Borders Media shares and creates content in support of the struggles of the working class and oppressed peoples and in opposition to capitalism and colonialism. Check us out on SoundCloud and our active social media, including Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky Threads, Twitter, and Mastodon, for links to upcoming and previous shows. Let's go to our interview with Mustafa Hanawe of the Immigrant Workers Center right now. I'm speaking with Mustafa Hanawe. Mustafa is an organizer with the Immigrant Workers Center in Montreal. He's also the author of Essential Work, Disposable Workers, Migration, Capitalism, and Class. It was published by Fernwood Books in 2023. Mustafa is talking to us on No Borders Media from his home, his small apartment in Park Extension. Mustafa, welcome again to No Borders Media.
Thank you, Jaggy. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on No Borders Radio, and always appreciate the perspective that No Borders Media brings to community radio and to more important discussions on movement building and where we go.
It's nice to hear that, Moose. Moose, you and I share both a political and personal history. You know, we've been comrades and friends and been organizing for the last 20 years, and sometimes in the exact same groups and mobilizations, and often supportive of each other and the work that we're doing in migrant justice organizing, anti-capitalism, international solidarity, working class organizing. We're both from Toronto, but we've lived in Montreal for a long time. So we share this generation of comradeship in the last 20 years, and that's something I'll be going back to a bit in this interview. And I've known you, Moose, to be a really generally an optimistic person. You know, you bring a positive perspective to organizing, but, you know, the current political context is not optimistic for people who share our politics. It's been the overall rise of the far right worldwide, you know, entrenching itself, normalizing itself. So beyond leaders like Trump or Milei in Argentina or Modi in India, you just have the normalization of far-right ideas. The aims of migrant justice that you and I have been organizing around for years are completely suffocated by the far-right and far-right talking points. You have symbolic things like the shutdown of Roxham Road, but it just seems like we're on the back foot when it comes to migrant justice organizing and confronting the normalization of these far-right talking points. We're living a cost of living crisis. Nobody really talks about confronting neoliberalism. So I just put that all out there because I know you're an optimistic person, but I'm just wondering, you know, your take on the current political climate we're in right now. Do you share that view? What keeps you optimistic or keeps you hopeful as we confront these harsh realities? And when I say all this, I just want to say I'm an optimistic person too. I believe these things can change. We have to continue organizing. But still, I just want to get your perspective on this sort of outline I've given of where we're at right now as we speak in March of 2024.
No, I mean, I think definitely if you look at it, I mean, it can seem hard to be optimistic, right? I mean, you know, if from every angle and every perspective, local, globally, you know, whether you're talking about the genocide in Gaza, whether you're talking about, Modi cementing another victory in India, Malay in Argentina, you know, essentially even now Trump is solidified as the Republican candidate and will be the forerunner. And the liberals backpedaling here, especially when it comes to the level of migrant scapegoating, when you're talking about international students, when you're talking about the blaming migrants or scapegoating migrants for the housing crisis, and that every solution to you know, a crisis of capitalism is ostensibly more neoliberalism. Well, actually, no. I mean, that is actually more complex. But it can seem like a really difficult moment that we're living in. And I think, you know, in some regards, you know, what we're beginning to see is clarity, I think. I think that to me is the only optimistic thing about the moment we're living in. You know, the thing that really keeps me optimistic is I think the vast majority, and this is a result of Palestine, really. I mean, this is the tragedy of what's taking place in Gaza, is that people realize that only by building actual movements on the ground can things change, right? That there is no more reliance on established political parties of any stripes, and that our politics and, you know, our demands can only be won on the streets. And I think there's a massive clarity about that too, right? I mean, the fact that despite, you know, the level of violence and the level of political support, whether it be from, you know, the Canadian Liberal Party, whether it be, you know, in Europe, that there's absolutely no pathway for real social change or real justice or dignity through the electoral process. And it's a joke. And I mean, I think there's that kind of clarity too. And, you know, and I think a lot of people, not just the left, you know, but people who are deeply concerned about what they're seeing realize that that they actually have to participate in organizing and activism in their neighborhoods and mass demonstrations and boycotts and shutting down arms companies and trying to stop arms exports. So I think that I think we're going back to that moment where there's mass disillusionment with the political process. And, you know, liberals are trying to hold on to power as a result of that too, because of that disillusionment coming from that sort of, you know, xenophobic, more right-wing extra parliamentary political forces, you know, that are backing these far-right politicians. But, you know, that's the moment we're living in. So to me, that's actually the kind of the, if any, optimism or hope for optimism. But I think the big question is, and I think probably this is going to come up throughout our discussion, is actually, and I think it's true, I don't think we can go back to the language maybe that we were using 20 years ago. How do we describe the moment we're in? How do we find a new way of making all of those links, whether it be the housing crisis, or maybe we don't, the housing crisis, migration, what's taking place in Palestine? How do we interweave all of those struggles? How do we converge all of those struggles again and talk about the world we're living in? I mean, I think it's not going to be an easy process, but it's absolutely necessary if we're going to build a mass movement beyond just what we're seeing now in terms of Palestine.
Moose, you talked about the clarity that this political moment or political atmosphere brings, but I want to sort of complicate that a bit by talking about the cognitive dissonance of it as well. I've mentioned already to our listeners that you and I share, you know, about two decades of organizing together. So we've lived through what I would describe as, you know, moments that where we felt like we were winning, or at least we were getting somewhere. So I refer, for example, to the so-called anti-globalization or global justice movement of the late 90s, early 2000s. I refer to the anti-war movement, which, although it didn't stop the war in Iraq, you know, was a huge, huge movement around the world. We can even refer to Occupy movement of 2011 and 2012. And all those things have their faults, of course, you know, each of the movements I described, but at least we felt like, I feel, that we were getting somewhere. Now, here we are in 2024, and this cognitive dissonance I'm about to describe has been the case for at least the last 4 to 8 years. You have a far right and sometimes out and out fascist right that speaks in terms of a ruling class and the elites. They've, in some cases, they managed to successfully portray large segments of the left as being the elite. they're the ones who talk about not getting involved in foreign wars. Now, obviously, we can easily debunk where they're coming from, but this cognitive dissonance does reach large segments of people who we want to reach, who are the working class, who are us. So I just want to complicate that a bit. And I know you and I have talked face to face about this cognitive dissonance, about how, you know, back 20 years ago, we were talking about criticizing free trade agreements, and then that language is appropriated and misappropriated by people like Trump. We've been talking for over two decades and longer about how the US and Canada and Western powers should not be bombing elsewhere in the world. And that language is appropriated by the far right. So maybe if you can, it's a big order I'm giving you here, but or a big challenge, but reconcile that clarity that comes out of the moment with that cognitive dissonance that I've just expressed.
No, I mean, definitely. I mean, you're right. I mean, what's sad. So if you look at this, like, even now with Palestine, right, there is a section of this, like, isolationist, you know, far right, like the Tucker Carlsons, the Judge Napolitano, you know, who was essentially Fox News correspondent for quite some years. And what's happening is that, you know, they want the U.S. out of Ukraine. They want the U.S. out of Gaza, out of Israel. But what they actually want is they want a war on migrants, right? They want, you know, it's we should be fighting the war at home, essentially, is their logic. And China. And actually, a lot of them have this very even overt racist logic about the Ukraine-Russian question, is that, you know, before the conservative strategy during the Cold War was to isolate China from Russia, right? But now you have the opposite, and you have these, and they use a kind of a very coded language, right? That we share much more culturally, quote unquote, with Russia, and we have much more of the same values and the same. So essentially, it's like we should be treating them like white Europeans, and because we share nothing with this, you know, this authoritarian Chinese. I'm not saying I'm pro the Chinese Communist Party, but you know, their isolationism is towards a very twisted logic, and a lot of the people. I mean, the thing is, there is this cognitive dissonance, right? Where, I mean, to me, I think one of the things that we need to go back to is, like, how do you see the freedom of movement for people, but not for capital, right? How do we have actual control over our economy? Because even the people that are beginning to back the Trumps and the Malays of the world, they really don't care about actual working class people, particularly even rural white, right? It's for political gain, right? It's not that they actually genuinely have their interest, right? In the terms of, you know, many of these people are, you know, there are hedge funds and on Wall Street that are beginning to back it. You know, Jamie Dimon is also beginning to back Trump. So there's all of this, you know, in terms of actually, this is just going to benefit the, you know, 1% or the, you know, a bit larger, but the actual capitalist class in the U.S., right? So there's no, there's going to be no benefit. But it's true. The question is, how do we begin to reach? How do we begin to speak to those segments? So there's, I mean, the question is, how can we actually rebuild those links and those struggles that actually that we were doing 2 decades ago, but just sort of refreshed in a way where we can do that now, and that they're part of the same convergence. Maybe they're not going to be in the same room constantly, but I mean, I think also the big problem, and I think the reason why there's this cognitive dissonance, especially on the left right now, is that, I mean, this is the sad part. There's been this turn away from actually trying to build movements that are actually grounded. And I think that is the sad part. So if you look at the difference between, you know, 2 decades ago and now, you know, the kinds of the political outlooks of, you know, of trying to build and support self-organized communities, to do tenant organizing, you know, squats with low income, you know, with people who are in social housing or who are homeless, you know, the OCAP model, you know, the CLAC Committee Logement, or the No One Is Illegal model. All of those models, I'm not saying that we have to go back directly to what was being done, is less and less the political orientation that a lot of people on the left have right now. And I think that is part of like the you know, the big reason that cognitive dissidence too. No one's saying that, guys, we need to actually build a base. Because unfortunately, the kind of the moment that we're in where it's kind of just about me doesn't require to think about what does a mass movement look like? What does a mass organization look like? What does anti-capitalist politics actually in communities look like? And we grappled with those questions 20 years ago. And maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like we're not, we don't grapple with those questions in the same way anymore.
Mustafa, I'm curious about and intrigued by the phrase you just used, turn away, you know, the left or portions of the left have turned away from movements that are grounded. You know, what's that turn away to? You know, I don't want to get into it too much because this isn't about bashing other people or anything, but are you talking about performative politics, you know, what people call clicktivism, the focus on identity politics? Not that either you and I are opposed to, you know, the fact that people organize on identities, but like the fact that that becomes the be-all or end-all of how we organize rather than, you know, grounded in organizing working class politics. So could you maybe flesh that out a little bit more?
I mean, I think definitely, I mean, this sort of the online activism and sort of the, you know, clicktivism and, but also, I think part of it is more of an individualization of activism and a hope for spontaneity, right? And I think also as some of the issues, you know, we've all been engaged with have become mainstream in a way, they've been devoid of politics. And, you know, if you look at indigenous sovereignty and you know, anti-colonial struggles here, you know, it's a very strange, if you think back, you know, like 20 years ago, like no one was talking about, you know, land acknowledgements and indigenous solidarity, but now it's quite mainstreamed. But does that have any teeth? Does that have any, you know, what has actually been built through that and within that, you know? And I think that is like, you know, one example. So when there are these, you know, uproars and you know, in terms of certain particular struggles, then it's easy for people to latch on. They don't have to do the work of building solidarity and relationships. And then they move on. And the same thing we saw with sort of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, when, you know, then when there's a thought as how do we actually connect these ways in a real radical way that's going to challenge capitalism, that's going to challenge colonialism? How do we relate that to workers? There isn't, because those issues have become mainstream. So there's no intent to be like, where does this point this towards in terms of like any, you know, furthering radical politics or like a radical political project? So I guess in a way it is just performative in that moment, and it's easily usurped. So I think, you know, and I think, you know, we were probably harsher on ourselves 25 years ago than we should have been. And maybe we would have been in a different place too.
Moose, you talked about how one way to reconcile the cognitive dissonance, the fact that huge elements of the far right just appropriate language that we would have been using around both international conflicts as well as, you know, the cost of living and different crises that are happening locally. You know, one way you reconcile that is that what the far right is doing is talking about a war on migrants. They want to focus on other scapegoats. Internationally, that would be places like China, as you said. But in terms of day-to-day issues, it would be blaming migrants. So, you know, here in Quebec or in the rest of Canada, we blame migrants for the cost of living crisis or the housing crisis. And I guess if we're going to be thorough, we would say not only are migrants blamed, but queer and trans communities, specific communities within migrant communities, such as Muslims, the elements of the far right will take on feminism as a whole. But in terms of that one chunk, the war on migrants, it's like we need someone to write a book about this and explore this topic. And as it happens, you've written that book. It's called Essential Work, Disposable Workers, Migration, Capitalism, and Class. So a lot of the topics we're discussing relate to a lot of the themes that you've explored in your book, which was written, which was published in 2023, but it's based on, you know, 20 years of organizing. So maybe quickly, if you can, because I really want to get into some of the specific topics in your book. It's a, you know, it's a 12 chapter book, almost 200 pages. And I know you had to keep a lot out. Otherwise, it probably would have been twice or three times as long. Give our listeners an overview of Essential Work, Disposable Workers, Migration, Capitalism, and Class. What are you trying to convey in terms of the topics we've talked about already? What are you trying to convey to a general public about this?
I mean, one of the things I'm trying to convey is that, you know, is that really that there's never been a migrant crisis, right? There's been really a crisis of capitalism, right? And that you can only understand, you know, the main theme, one of the main themes is that you can only understand migration is by actually situating it in capitalism as a global system and what happened to the global south, right? Because, you know, most migration outside of, you know, colonial and forced migrations in the past, you know, in terms of sort of, you know, migration in terms of the, you know, the actual movement of people from to the global north, from the global south in a mass way only begins in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, and a lot of that I talk about in the book is a result of sort of the, you know, the US-led capitalism, imperialism, you know, the structural adjustment programs imposed by the World Bank and the IMF, export-led development, sort of the maquiladoras and the export processing zones are really central to understanding the displacement of people from the global south to the global north. And that, you know, that failure of that model of globalization, you know, is really at the root of migration. And, you know, for a general public, especially maybe even one that's susceptible to far-right ideas, it doesn't matter how high the walls are. People are going to come. People's, you know, communities have been decimated. No agricultural livelihood, no public education systems, no public healthcare systems. Countries vastly in debt, and in debt to where? To here, to Wall Street, to London, to the World Bank, to the IMF. And so, you know, and these aren't failed states. These are the darlings of globalization, right? So Egypt, the Philippines, Guinea, Nigeria, Mexico. And so I talk about those examples in the book as being, these are the largest, you know, quote unquote, labor exporters in the world. And so the way that the book talks about it is that, you know, there's this term that gets used now, is that circular migration, and what they want, and what for capital, what they want is they want the freedom of movement, but not really the freedom of movement. What they want is migrants to move as labor, as economic migrants, but never to really be welcomed in their host countries, because they'll never remit. So there always has to be this link back to where they came from. And so the models of Canada become paramount, and, you know, sort of are moved towards temporary migration. And the reason, you know, and understanding the sort of the violence that you see in the border violence that you see in the US or in Fortress Europe, a lot of that is to re-engineer their immigration regimes to mimic that of Canada. I mean, Trump says it again and again and again. He said it in his first State of the Union address. What he seeks to create is a Canada-style immigration system based on temporary labor programs and merit-based permanent residency. Because in the U.S., they still rely on, their system is still based on chain migration. They have a large pool of undocumented labor. And thus, for a lot of employers, there's no incentive to go through bureaucratic loopholes to use existing guest worker programs, like the H-1B-1 visa. So, and the problem is for the, you know, for the U.S. And particularly in Europe, you know, there's a hesitancy also to actually to enforce and to make it, you know, a functional immigration regime based on temporary labor. But I, you know, a lot of this violence is premised on that. You know, in sort of, there's the overt Islamophobia or racism. So one example, you know, I talk about in the book is Egypt. And you can now, you know, Egypt accounts for the highest number of irregular migrants to the European Union. But Egypt is also a labor exporter to Southern Europe. So Italy, Greece, also to Cyprus, you know, for seasonal agricultural work, fishing in Greece, warehousing and food processing in Italy. And they go on these guest worker programs. So you can have two boats leave the coast of Egypt heading to Europe. One with Egyptian migrants, Muslim, with guest worker visas, and they're not deemed a threat. And you can have another boat, again, with Egyptians, without that visa, seeking asylum, and a better livelihood from a failed dictatorship backed by the U.S., and they're deemed a threat. And the reason they're deemed a threat is because they're seeking migration on their own terms, not on the terms of capital, not on the terms of the need. And so, to me, I think the anti-migrant discourse, it's not so much about the movement of people, but I think it's about the what they don't want is migration on its own terms. Because if people go with permanent residency, if people have status, if they have citizenship, if they are equal in all of their rights, that doesn't make them cheap labor. That doesn't make them disposable. And so that's really the contradiction in the book, is that they need this cheap labor power, but they need it to be disposable, because then it's no longer profitable. And so the book really looks at, you know, a whole host of examples, but I really try to show how migrant labor isn't actually marginal to global capitalism anymore, right? So, and it goes to these other crises, right? So if we look at our agricultural system, I mean, it's basically, it's propped up by migrants, whether it be green housing, agriculture, food processing, restaurants, delivery. These are primarily migrant jobs across the industrialized world. And then, and the reason why that labor power gets cheapened and cheapened and cheapened is because what you have in a local way, the same structure that you have in globalization, right? You have one or two corporations. So in Canada, we have three corporations that account for 70% of our food distribution. So Metro, Loblaws, Sobeys, that really account for the lion's share of the food we buy, and essentially an oligopoly. And because they control the entire food industry, they control the price they buy all of the products. So I talk about all of these local examples from the IWC. So someone we know quite closely, Noe, who worked, a Guatemalan seasonal agricultural worker, who was working for a tomato greenhouse company called Savura. He was, you know, he was fired for standing up for a coworker who had been injured, and they wouldn't call the hospital. You know, he was essentially been, he's now, you know, it was an incredible organizer, but, you know, now has status. And Savura is considered the tomato king in Quebec. It has revenues of $250 million. But all of it is because they have exclusive contract to Metro. But Metro dictates the kind of tomatoes, the schedule of the tomatoes, the price of the tomatoes. So the bulk of the lion's share of profit is held by Metro. And a lot of that is in all of the things that these companies sell, because essentially they control our entire, you know, food market. And so they control what we eat and at what price we're going to buy. So you actually, migrants have actually lowered the price and raised the profits. So if you actually, you know, are concerned about inflation and our food systems, you know, there's that easy link. We should be standing with migrants, because who they're fighting against is also Loblaws, they're fighting against is also Metro and this price hiking, because they don't see the profits. Right. And if they were able to organize, that would actually benefit everyone in society. You know, so I also talk about, you know, Amazon as being a very similar situation, or the whole gig economy. So when we think about inequality, the Gilded Age, the quote unquote elite, they're not pro migrant. They've reaped their lion's share of profit as a result of migration. You know, the bulk of Amazon's workforce, 1.5 million workers, are racialized workers. I mean, they're not all migrant, you know, because the vast majority are in the U.S., so Black and Latina, second, third generation, but also immigrant labor. And, you know, and they're the ones who created the wealth and profit for the richest man on earth, who literally went to space on their back. And, you know, if you look at Uber, you know, Uber is the largest taxi company on earth. I mean, it claims to have 3 million drivers, but they're all quote unquote gig workers. They're all autonomous, and their vast majority are migrants. And so, you know, when we think about even this reckoning with this, the level of inequality in the Gilded Age, it's actually these migrant workers who are precarious and invisibilized and are deemed disposable, one day deemed essential during the pandemic, who actually have a major role in reshaping the world we live in and the struggles. And a lot of the same things that are the talking points now, the far right, inequality, inflation, you know, this gilded elite and the gilded age we live in, right? Migrants aren't benefiting from it. They're actually being hyper exploited by it. So how do we make those links between those? So I talk about that in the book too. And the last part of the book is really about thinking through a lot of the organizing in the last two decades, and the different models, and you know, whether it be, you know, new unions like the New York Taxi Workers Alliance that we both, you know, have relationships with, whether it be different worker centers like the Immigrant Workers Center, and also, you know, and also the migrant justice movement, you know, more broadly, and thinking how we're going to win status, right? So talking about the Sans Papier strikes in Paris in 2008, the Day Without an Immigrant in 2006 is being really still to this day, largest demonstrations in U.S. history. And so, and the one thing, and that maybe we can talk about, and is a lot of the self-organized migrant communities here in Montreal and in Toronto over the last two decades, and thinking about it in a way of, you know, the movement becomes effective when we have these networks of these like communities of resistance, right? They've actually built a sense, not just a political identity, but also a real community, right? Sharing meals, building these deeper connections. And that really helps these, you know, especially these migrants thrive and claim the space and be willing to take the risks and be willing more to organize. And I think one of the big lessons from the book is that movements also just take time. You can't skirt time. So I talk about, you know, the book ends with this chapter on the long road for status for all. You know, it began in 2003. I mean, you know, began in really 2001 with No One Is Illegal and the formation of No One Is Illegal after 9/11. You know, and now we're beginning to see the discussion of a broad regularization program. But the movement took two decades to get there. And I, so I, you just can't skirt time, unfortunately. And I think a lot of activists, we get cognitive dissonance real quick. And I think we don't think long enough. We don't think what does it mean to be around in 5 or 10 years. We're constantly in the mode of the next action, the next campaign, maybe. We're not thinking about what does it mean to build this in 5 or 10 or 15 years. And so to me, and then, you know, and the last part, the book, I really try to make this, you know, the argument that, like, we have to reclaim that space. We just can't talk about migrant justice without talking about anti-capitalism, because if we don't, we're going to face, you know, real roadblocks. And it's also not just about appeasing, you know, other sections of the working class. But also, if you don't talk about that, you deny migrants the kind of agency that they actually have, which is their role in the capitalist system. It's not to romanticize it or to say that it's positive, but, you know, that there's the potential of real power, of real movement building.
Most, that's a pretty thorough overview of your book. And I do want to explore, I mean, we could spend hours exploring different aspects of what you described from, you know, the neoliberal migration that's taken hold. And I mean, you explore in your book from the Philippines to Mexico, to Guinea, to Egypt, to how precarious work requires precarious workers. But before exploring one of these topics, I just wanted to sort of do a side point here, because you talked about how we need to, you know, look at the long term, but we're also often caught up in, you know, the day to day and the immediacy of things. And it reminds me of a graphic that an artist, Laura Chow Reeve, and an author, Dan Berger, who you and I both know, put together, that kind of, I think, encapsulates this this often feeling of, you know, we might not be doing enough. So it sort of puts together two contradictory statements. You know, like, our actions are working, but they're not enough. Nothing we do is sufficient, but everything we do matters. We must be strategic, but we must also operate on multiple fronts simultaneously. And just addressing the point you made, you know, time is of the essence, but we also have to act in the long haul. I think we're always balancing both, and that's exactly how change happens, which is what the graphic says, and which is what I think a lot of us that have been involved in organizing for a long time realize. Sometimes it just feels like it's, you know, we're dealing with the immediacy of it, but that is also part of building for the long haul. So that's just a little parenthesis that I thought is worth adding, because, you know, this is a show, at least this one in particular, is about, you know, movement politics and taking the time to reflect. Now, to go back to your book, earlier in this interview, you know, I referenced, you know, sort of other touchstone points in both of our organizing, such as the anti-globalization movement, the anti-war movement, Occupy. But I do know that there was a moment that was enormously inspiring for you and I both, that we weren't directly part of, but that we observed, and you've already referenced it, and that was the mass immigrant rights protests that took place in the United States in 2006. And as you already said, these were the largest scale protests in American history. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of protesters in major cities, but also tens of thousands of protesters in small towns. So it's one thing to have, you know, 500,000 people protesting in LA. It's another thing when you got 40,000 in Boise, Idaho. But that goes to show two things, which is that we can have a strong movement that mobilizes itself, but also that the reality of migrant labor is everywhere, from Southern California to parts of rural United States. So maybe talk to our listeners more. I mean, you give two examples in your book. You talk about 2006, and you also talk about the sans-papier strikes in Paris, which I believe took place in the 2016 period. But the sans-papier movement in Europe, especially in France, has been strong since a church was first occupied back in the 90s, and people started using the term sans-papier. So talk about this idea of striking for status. Why is it so inspiring to you? I know part of your organizing over the years has been to organize MayWorks and May Day protests. The Day Without an Immigrant in 2006 was scheduled to take place on May 1st and sort of reclaim that tradition of a combative working class movement, a working class project against capitalism, which I know is a term you use in your book. So talk about that specific chapter in your book about striking for status.
Well, I mean, the chapter Striking for Status is really just, you know, it's a homage to that, right? It's that if migrants saw themselves as part of the working class, not, you know, being separate from it, then there's a lot of power, right? It's not just being invisible and hyper exploited, but there is the actual potential to bring the entire economy to a halt. And to me, also, it goes speaks to also a bigger problem on the left, right? We talk about union decline. We talk about, you know, which the far right manipulates, deindustrialization, offshoring, you know, all of the old models of the left are decimated, right? So the old parties, mass unions, and there's just been this constant secular decline. And even, well, people might say, well, Canada, we're not like the US where union density is like 11%. You know, in Canada, it's still 30%. In Quebec, it's 40%. But if you remove the public sector, because we have a large public sector, the numbers aren't that far off. You know, in Quebec, it's less than 20% of the private sector is organized. So that's quite actually a low number. And the idea that, you know, immigrants and migrants don't want to join unions or don't want to organize, this is about rebuilding the whole labor movement, right? It's not just about only for migrant for justice. So the idea that the fact that, you know, these migrants in the U.S. used their position as workers and being part of the working class and actually May Day, you know, they used, I mean, May Day was historically always been an immigrant workers' day, right? At the beginning, the very first May Day. I mean, it was European immigrant workers, but they were immigrants. And so, to use their actual, you know, to have a general strike of immigrants on May 1st, that's astoundingly political. And it was astoundingly, you know, for a short while, was really central to rebuilding the labor movement in places like California and New York, and building the links between workplace struggles and migrant justice struggles, and was real a catalyst. So to me, you know, the striking for status, it's not just about winning status for all, and that's how they're going to win it. But it's the idea that they're going to rebuild they're central to rebuilding a labor movement and a broader left, that can, a combative broader left and anti-capitalist left. And so, and I think by, you know, organizing workplaces, not just around bread and butter workplace issues, but for status, which is so central to so many people with precarious status. You know, for example, we've been flyering at Dollarama for over 10 years. They're hyper-exploited, you know, at the big warehouse. And they're hyper-exploited. They're all asylum seekers or, you know, people waiting for their deportation orders. You know, they work through temp agencies. But for them, the question of being able to stay with permanent residency is the key issue. So if you organize on those lines, as a union, as workers, you've won people over to the labor movement. And I think the other important aspect of even the A Day Without an Immigrant strike in 2006 was it showed their power, right? So, I mean, there's a joke, I mean, but it's partially true. There was actually a film, a sort of a comedic film that was done before that, A Day Without a Mexican. And, you know, it's about Mexicans disappearing from the U.S. and people can't go to a restaurant, people can't do anything. But, you know, the idea, the symbol of it, that they have real power, that they weren't just marginal, that they just weren't invisible. So to me, that's the big takeaway. And a lot of the other thing is that, again, it wasn't spontaneous. It took time. There was the March 25th coalition in the U.S. High school students walked out first in the spring. And then that led to the organizing for the general strike on May 1st. But I mean, also that it is possible if we strategically think that way and we build that way.
Mustafa, we can spend hours, as I've said, exploring the topics in your book, but let's go back to the more local. And by local, I mean here in Canada, in Quebec. And one way to maybe to approach this question and some of the topics we've been discussing and during this interview is the recent death of former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. Mulroney was Prime Minister between 1983 and 1994, and he, along with other figures, but he, especially in Canada, was responsible for entrenching neoliberal politics in Canada. He brought in the free trade agreement with the United States. He brought in what we now call austerity, but basically cutbacks to medical healthcare system, brought in privatization. We live with these realities today when we talk about an underfunded healthcare system, when we talk about not having sort of a commons anymore, but rather a private sector being emphasized. That's all because of these policies. And there were all kinds of honors given to Mulroney after his death. You even had one pundit who claimed that if not for Mulroney, maybe Nelson Mandela might not be free. That's how bad it was. But, you know, they ignored this horrible economic reality that he imposes, as well as ignoring the fact, of course, that it was the Mulroney government that brought in Canadian troops into OCA and et cetera. But I feel like Mulroney gives us an excuse to talk about those politics that have entrenched themselves here in the Canadian state. Within years of Mulroney leaving power in 93, you'd have an anti-globalization movement that would confront this head on, that would confront NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the Summit of the Americas. So I just want to use that as an opening to talk about how this neoliberal politics plays out here. So it's allowing you to sort of take a walk in memory lane in terms of, you know, that politics when we were very young and its ramifications today. And I guess before you answer that, I did want to say one point about the Day Without an Immigrant. It's pretty stunning where we're at now, because 18 years after those mass strikes that succeeded in overturning a law that would have made people who help migrants criminals, 18 years later, we're on the verge of re-electing Donald Trump, who promises to engage in mass deportations and in doing so will get militias to do it for him. Not to mention that Biden has basically come around to 90% of what Trump wants anyways, except for perhaps the roundups. Biden is all about putting up a wall and the rest of it. So it's pretty stunning how things have changed. But I want to sort of bring it back to the Canadian side of things and talk about this neoliberalism that Mulroney brought in, a neoliberalism that you explore in your book, of course, in detail. So that's an opening for you to use the death of Brian Mulroney to talk about our current economic and political realities.
No, I mean, it's sad no one is equating Mulroney right now to Thatcher and then the way, you know, the people in England treated Thatcher after she had passed away. He doesn't have that same goodbye. I mean, the thing about the, you know, in terms of the introduction of free trade and privatization, the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, you know, and then the, you know, negotiations around NAFTA. I mean, be opposed to these things, you know, quite openly and quite articulately, you know, and we won over unions to these things. I mean, here's a sad reality. When Trump was renegotiating NAFTA, you know, Unifor, the old Canadian auto workers, was protesting for NAFTA. That's how far it's gone. So deep it's become entrenched, right? You know, the same union that was protesting NAFTA at its inception and the Summit of the Americas and the Free Trade Area of the Americas was now protesting to keep what they have. That's how far capital or these corporations have been able to go that that workers and working class people just want to keep the crumbs that they have now and don't want it to go any further. And I think there's a fear of really saying, like, we should actually be in control of our economies, of our communities, based on really unfair trade, based or not even, you know, in the sense that actually, not the label, but, you know, in genuine sense of solidarity and you know, free exchange of goods. And but, you know, that, the, you know, we, this is not about actual trade. This is about the control of the privatizing of a further, you know, services, privatizing of public institutions and public services, of diminishing our democracies, you know, all of those critiques, you know, land theft, you know, they're far gone, right? And we had no movement. I mean, I think there's a lot of fear. It's like, you're not gonna celebrate Trump for saying that is a bad deal, but there should have been a left critique of saying that this might be an opportunity to say that actually, you know what? F it. We don't want this free trade agreement, and we're going to build a movement. And this is not about renegotiating, but it's actually about ending this agreement, because it doesn't work for anyone in Mexico, working class people in the U.S., and working class people here. So really have to reclaim that space again and that trajectory, right, in terms of globalization, in terms of anti-globalization, in terms of privatization, but not from a position of nationalism, but from a position of you know, solidarity, of democracy, and the interests of all. But I think we gotta begin to do that again. But that's my own take, because a lot of this is what the stakes are really that high. And I think it's, yeah, I mean, it's the only way we're going to undermine this growing fascism, right? And this the kind of the moment we're in. Goodbye to Moroni.
Good riddance.
Good riddance, yeah.
Yeah. By the way, his funeral is scheduled, services are scheduled here in Montreal for March 23rd. They're really keeping him lying in state for a long time. So there is an opportunity to have sort of a nostalgic protest outside of his funeral to remind everyone about everything that he was responsible for and his policies were responsible for. Again, even beyond the neoliberalism stuff, the sending in the army at Oka, the corruption. I mean, people forget about the Airbus affair and things like that. It's pretty stunning the way his memory has been sanitized. But Mustafa, just thank you so much for sharing your thoughts today. There's a lot that we can explore, but just for lack of time, I want to remind our listeners to check out Mustafa's book, Essential Work, Disposable Workers, Migration, Capitalism, and Class. It was published in 2023 by Fernwood Books. Also, I think I certainly speak for Mustafa when I encourage our listeners to be involved with the various anti-capitalist, working class, migrant justice struggles that are around in your own communities. Here in the Canadian state, there's going to be a migrant spring as the movements that are fighting for status for all continue their mobilizations and try to push the Canadian government to implement a inclusive, ongoing regularization program. So once again, thanks, Mustafa, for speaking with us on No Borders Media.
Thank you, Jackie, for having me and for the incredible exchange and discussion.
Do you realize consciousness is affected? There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
That wraps up the March 2024 edition of No Borders Media. We were listening to a feature interview with Mustafa Hanawe, an organizer with the Immigrant Workers Center in Montreal, as well as the author of Essential Work, Disposable Workers, Migration, Capitalism, and Class. No Borders Media is an autonomous left-wing media network. We share and create content that supports the struggles of communities in resistance with a focus on the self-determination struggles of Indigenous peoples, migrants, refugees, and working-class people of color in the context of opposition to capitalism and colonialism. Stay tuned for Upstage.